everybody, and welcome to a very, very, very special episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, a podcast all about board games, and the people who love board games. My name is Quentin Smith, and I'm going to be joined on this rather special pod odyssey by a rather normal man, Tom Brewster. How's it going, Tom?
Firstly, ouch. But secondly, I was kind of surprised at how many verys you put on that special episode. It's quite a normal episode of the podcast, isn't it?
That's rude. It's not, because usually we have to talk about, for business and financial reasons, talk about games that are new,
right?
Games that have been sent to us by publishers, games that people on Reddit are like, oh, I can't believe they haven't, if you're on Reddit, that's what you sound like, don't deny it.
Can confirm.
I can't believe they haven't reviewed, I don't know, Nidavellir or whatever. But on this episode of the podcast, Tom and I have said no.
No.
We just had an entire day of games that we played with some friends because we wanted to, because they were good. Because Tom said, Quins, why don't we ever play good things anymore? And I was like, that's a good point, actually. And I curated four games from my historic board game collection that you simply hadn't played, and neither had your friends.
Yes.
And it was rather special. And those games we're going to be talking about on this podcast, four little classics, in my humble opinion. Tom might disagree. We'll find out live on this podcast. I brought a couple of classic Reinach-Nitzia games. I brought Taj Mahal, a game of traveling around India and plopping down little plastic palaces. And I brought Samurai, a game of traveling around Japan and plopping down little cardboard armies. And then I brought a couple of card games as we decamped to the pub. I brought Mundus Novus, a deeply colonialist game about trading trade goods like, you know, tobacco and potatoes from the New World in South America, and taking them back to Spain for king and country or whatever. I don't know. It's colonialism. So if I'm kind of hazy on the theme, it's partially through white guilt. And then we played Parade, a game by a Japanese designer that's about trying not to collect characters from Alice in Wonderland unless you do collect them. And we'll get into the weeds of that later. Tom, did you have fun?
I had lots of fun, although I'm sort of realizing that our day of games that we played to not make content about them because we just wanted to play fun games has turned into content once again.
Well, yeah, no, that is depressing. But you know what the good part of turning this into content is we can announce to everybody the little special twist I put on this day of games. Would you like to describe to the people at home what happened?
Quins brought a tiny little wooden treasure chest to this selection of board games that we started about like 2 o'clock, ended maybe like 8 or 9 or 10 p.m. in the evening. So it was a long day of games. And Quins bought
the pub was closing, so it must have been like 11.
Yeah, it was a late one. And Quins bought this tiny little treasure chest with him. That was the prize for whoever won the most games or whoever placed the highest across all of the games. We realized that all of the games that you brought, we could have a winner and then a second place and a third place and a fourth place because they all kind of like cut that way. And he brought this little treasure chest. I think you enticed us with the idea that inside the value of whatever was inside was £20, which got everyone very excited.
Slightly more than £20, yeah. But I wouldn't let you have a peek inside my treasure.
No.
You had to win to do that. And then who got to peek inside my treasure, Tom?
You did, Quins.
I didn't need to because I knew what was in there. But yeah, I won. I got first place, second place, which was enough to secure me the day's treasure.
So, like, first off, you sound really cool right now. But secondly,
I'm smiling as I record this.
I couldn't believe that you wouldn't let us have a little peek in the treasure chest. And then you floated the suggestion as well that if we did this again, you would actually put something else in the treasure chest or not even bring a treasure chest, bring something else. And it made like multiple of us like actually scream at the table, except for Luke. Luke was very chill with it. He sort of managed to, he didn't mind.
We had so much fun that, yeah, I raised the idea that if we do it again and I brought four other new games you hadn't seen, I would place the pre-existing treasure chest inside a larger box that was also filled with treasure. And then it's a rollover at that point.
It's also, frankly, monstrous behavior that you brought four games that none of us had played, but you had, and then beat us at like half of them. And came second in the other half and then took the prize away. One might think that you would exclude yourself from the prize-giving ceremony as you had natural advantage, but no. Disgusting
behaviour.
Absolutely
not. Look, we've discussed this since, and because I hadn't played any of these games in at least 3 years, I'm not going to say it's the same as having never played them, But I like, if you had to play a game you hadn't played for 3 years, the advantage you would have would be minimal. And I would say that if you came into a casino, you would expect them to have like a house advantage, but you might also expect to walk away. I think I modeled that capably with the games that I brought. Like, is, because Quinn's got a small advantage? Yes. Could we beat him? Yes. Like, don't tell me that you weren't optimistic that you were, one of you was going to clinch it.
In the games that you won because you've played the game before. I
disagree. I think that's 10 years of board game experience letting me, like, let's not rehash this argument, but this time live. Let's get into the games and what you thought of them.
So the first game we played on our big day of fun-only games was Taj Mahal, designed by Rainer Knizia. We played the FFG Euro Classics version of this, I think, in its lovely, regal red box. So this game's kind of hard to explain. Thematically, it's like yet another Rainer Knizia game that could kind of be anything. It could be about anything. You're like, are you merchants in this game or are you builders?
No. The king of Mughal India is touring India to look at the land that he controls, and you are part of his entourage.
Right.
You're traveling around 12 distinct regions of India, and then every time you get somewhere, there's a series of auctions as you all try and buddy up to the king's, like, I don't know, the king's general and the king's elephant.
Yeah, absurd, like, to be honest. Like, the layers of remove that the game is from the theme is crazy.
Looks nice, though, doesn't it? Not that this edition really that I have nice. That you can't buy anymore looks gorgeous.
It does look really nice. It's got, I think we talked about this. This has been mentioned a few times about Taj Mahal, but the fact that its colours are just lovely. It's got such unusual, like, it's got kind of like typical colours for a board game. It's got red, it's got blue, it's got green, and it has yellow. But they're all just like a bit different, you know?
Yeah, the Pantone, like, catalog has been flipped open and they've picked a really good yellow and a really good red in a way that honestly makes me stunned that more board games don't do that. That I've been forced to play primary color red how many hundreds of times when I could have been playing this like lovely sort of slightly richer ruby color,
kind of
just
jewel like oh
wonderful
yeah, amazing. Anyway, let's get into the rules. So each player starts the game with a handful of these differently colored cards that have two different icons on them. You might have an elephant and a man, or a man and an elephant. The game is going to be this series of auctions where you're playing cards from your hand to have the most of these icons at any given time. Each auction takes place on a specific region of the board, and each region an auction are the rounds of the game. In each auction, players bid any single card from their hand and will sort of declare what symbols they have showing on them. So I might say, I've got two elephants, and the next person will play, and they don't have to like follow in that sort of currency, they'll just play whatever card they want from their hand as well. When it gets back to you, if you have the most of any number of icons, if you've got the most elephants, if that one elephant is more than anyone else around the table, then you can do one of two things. You can add more cards, continuing to up the bid so that you have the most of more symbols, or you can withdraw from the bidding and take the reward that's associated with having the most of that icon. And most of those victories will let you place these little palaces on the board. So if you have like the most of this sort of blue noble, which is one of the symbols, then you get to pick up one of the little palaces and put it on the board. And if you had the most of the blue noble and the dancer, you could place two palaces onto the board the moment that you withdraw from that auction. The big exception to that is these elephants, which will let you take the sort of token for the round, which will give you some trade goods that have like, it's not triangular scoring, it's just the more of them you have, the more points.
I don't think either of us right now on this podcast can remember exactly what triangular scoring is, but basically your first tea caddy gets you 1 point, your second tea caddy gets you 2 points, and so on.
Yes, exactly. So most of what this game is a game of like sunk cost fallacy, or more a game of like pulling out of an auction at exactly the right time. Like if you're ahead in something, it's whether you, or like, let's say you played a card that has one blue man and one green man, and then someone else around the table plays a card that gives them one green man. And in that moment, you've got, like, you can either be like, well, I'll take the green man, I'll take the blue man, and I'll leave. Or you can try and, like, just gently irritate your opponent by playing another card. Now you've got two green men and two blue men. And then you have this weird tension where, because you're all bidding in these currencies that slightly overlap, when you're playing, you're trying to block multiple people at once, or you're trying to get the edge in multiple fields at once. It's a very unusual auction.
It's really peculiar. There's nothing in my collection quite like Taj Mahal, which is why I've hung on to it. The key thing to add to all of this is that when you're bidding these cards for auction, you're actually not just bidding, you are spending them.
Yes.
So if I play a card with the Dancer and the General on, and then another player plays a card with the General, and another player plays a card with the Dancer, then it gets back to me. I've kind of just spent that card and got nowhere.
Yes.
So then you have to decide, what do you stop or do you keep fighting these players? And so what I would say is the emotional core of Taj Mahal is you play a card going, oh, I really hope I get the elephant this round. And someone else plays a card with an elephant and you look them in the eye and you go, don't do this. So there's no, because you don't get, like, there's no refilling your hands between auctions. And in fact, you get one or maybe two cards, unless you drop out without playing any cards at all, then you maybe get three. So players are, like, getting into a bidding war with anybody else is just inarguably awful for you both. And the rounds that just make you feel like this is the best game ever is when you play a card, sweat beads on your forehead as it goes around the table, no one else bids the same thing as you, and you can pull out. And so you've spent one card, you draw two, you got what you wanted, and you are the happiest person in India.
Yes. And then the flip side of that is that thing that you talked about where you play a card where you think you're going to try this round to swing multiple auctions at once, and then everyone just somehow steps on your toes, and then you end up wasting tons of cards on something that you don't really need, or maybe even don't get because people sneak out the win from under you because you can't, like, stay ahead in all the currencies at the same time.
Yeah, super peculiar. Rainer Knizia proving with this game from the 90s that, like, he's such a singular designer because he makes games that are so excruciatingly clever and then just fills them with, like, random chance and emotional bullshit. Like the Taj Mahal is such an intelligent game when you look at the board with this wonderful grid of cities and, like, you know, this really delicate card game. And fundamentally, it's not a game of engaging with either of those things. It's a game about hating the other players at the table and trying to spook them out of auctions by going, do you know how much I have the capacity to make you suffer? Like, thumbing through a massive hand of cards. It's really interesting.
There's stuff that we haven't even touched on, like the fact that all of the cards are of different colors. And you can only, once you start a bid with yellow cards, you can only continue to play yellow cards on top of that. And so there's this really fantastic, like, game of chicken that you're playing where you can see how big someone's hand is, but you're trying to guess at what proportion of that hand are even cards they can play right now, and whether you've got the sort of arsenal to beat them. And then on top of that, when you pull out of the auction, not only will you, like, take any rewards that you get then and there, there's a sort of market of cards that you'll be drawing from to then add to your hand to draw up from, and you get first pick of that as well. And so there's this really nice, like, there's, if you're playing this game and it's like upper levels, you've got two considerations. How much do you want what's on the board, and how much do you want what's in the market? Or how much do you not want to be the person who only gets to pull one card at the end of the round? Because there's an uneven number. It doesn't go round to all players. And also on top of that, like, I can't get over how much I enjoyed the way that the bids in this game were so sort of like conversational. They're not just like one number going up. It's not just like 5, 6, 7, and just people just jacking up a price and looking each other in the eye. It's like, you have these different icons that make them sort of like less readable as auctions, perhaps less immediate, but very like nuanced and fiddly. And there's lots of room for like play and strategy in there.
Yeah. It's a lot of someone plays a card and you look at it and you go, oh, that's fine. And then you look at your own card and realize that, no, actually you were bidding on the same thing as them. And then you go, oh no. So like, we're probably making this sound like it is phenomenal because we're both being excited and we're talking about nice colors, of which there are really nice colors. If you're then thinking, listening to this podcast and thinking you might scramble over to eBay or some board game marketplace and look for a secondhand copy of Taj Mahal, Tom and I might disagree. This game is really in my collection for two reasons. One, it's kind of peculiar. It's all right. And it looks gorgeous with the version that Wind Rider Games or FFG did when they rebooted it, in the noughties, or the tens. I'm not sure when that was, probably about 5, 6 years ago. Anyway, I don't think it's that good, but Tom is awfully excited. Have I got you right, Tom?
I think that this might have been either this or maybe Mundus Novus was my favorite game that we played. And I think it's, and I don't know how much Taj Mahal will bear repeat play, but I just think that I found it really like, I don't know, I just found it compelling in a way that I didn't find the other games. And I think that, like, I was thinking about this. You know how we had our predictions podcast where we were thinking about the rule being whoever wins gets to pinch a game from someone else's collection.
Dude, I was about to say that 5 minutes ago. I think this is a good candidate for a game you will rip out of my collection if you win the predictions podcast.
And I don't know if you'll miss it tremendously.
I might not. I might not. I have got a list that I've been assembling on a little post-it note next to my monitor recently, which is games that I feel I'm missing from my collection.
Yes.
And we talked about on the last podcast that I'm missing a Ryan Courtney game, and it's probably Curious Gargo, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Which is, just and- by the way, for the record, not a Domino's game.
I think it is. I think it is. It's a double-sided. It's a card of two segments. We'll get into this. I've got my lawyer ready for the next year's podcast. But I'm also missing an Azul, and I'm pretty tight for space. So you know, if you take Taj Mahal. Oh well, I mean, also I'm taking the company's copy of Armin Ray, which we're playing for the first time tomorrow.
Oh hell yeah!
So there's, you know, Taj Mahal and Armin Ray could swap. That could be cool. We got so many good games to talk about, though. Should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on. Let's talk about Samurai. Or maybe you should tell us about Samurai.
I'm going to take you into the land of the rising sun, which is to say Japan, or some of Japan. Because the first thing you'll notice about Reinek Nitze's Samurai, one of his what was referred to in the 90s as the tile-laying trilogy, which included Tigris and Euphrates and... Through the Desert.
Ooh.
I would say that Samurai is not as good as Through the Desert or Tigris and Euphrates, but I do really like it, and I cut myself off. The first thing you'll notice about it with this new Wind Rider Games FFG edition, when it got rebooted about, again, 5-6 years ago, is this lovely modular board. So whether you're playing Samurai with 2-3 or a full 4 people, as we did, you're going to jigsaw these pieces together to create a Japan-sized board that is... like just massive and really peculiar because it's all hexagons and you have to like jigsaw it together. So we played with the full country of Japan. So you're looking at this lovely sort of like white and blue board, all made up of hexagons. And what players are doing, once you cover the board in these little plastic pieces depicting either rice bushels for farmers, Buddhas for monks, I think, or religion. And then finally little castles representing the military. Now, Samurai is one of those Reinek Nitze games where it's much harder to teach than it is to play because, again, it is so idiosyncratic, and this is one of the game. This is one of the reasons it stays in my collection. To win Samurai, you're going to be basically spending the entire game placing little hexagons of your color on the board, and when you surround one of these statues, you trigger a little battle, and you look to see who has placed the highest numbers around it, the highest set of integers, and then whoever put more numbers into that fight takes the statue and puts it behind their screen. To win the game, you have to have the most of more kinds of statues than your opponents. So in a two-player game, that's easy. You just need to be the player that wins the most of two of the three shapes of statues, Buddhas, rice, and castles. In a four-player game, it becomes interesting because to win, you basically need to have the most of one type. So one of the players is eliminated because they didn't have the most. And then you go to the like sub-victory condition because the tiebreaker is... like, let's imagine I have all the rice. That's actually really bad because I'll have the most rice, thumbs up, but then the tiebreaker is how many of the other kinds of statues do you have? Mm-hmm. So Samurai has this really peculiar puzzle of you want to have the most of something, but just barely, and then put all of your attention into collecting other kinds of statues, which is hard because all the statues go behind screens. Like High Society, this is a Reinek Nitze game that... theoretically would advantage players who can memorize stuff. Mm. And Tom and I had a little discussion there of like Tom, like me, when I was younger, saying, this seems bad. And because I don't like memorizing, it's not fun. And I pointed out that is a valid criticism when he has played this game with someone who memorizes, which I have never done. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
High Society theoretically is a game that falls apart if you play with someone who can count cards, but I've never played with someone who can count cards. So is it really a problem? I don't know, but certainly some people in Board Game Geek comment threads think. Tom, would you I've rambled for a bit. Tom, would you like to describe how the system of the hand of cards, which is to say the hand of little hexagons, works in this game? The sort of how you actually play?
I think that the thing I liked about Samurai maybe the most was the fact that it is like a very, very direct and quite like simple teach, and that there's sort of no hidden information at the start of the game other than the contents of like your hand. You basically draw a hand of five tiles. Everyone has exactly the same set of tiles. So they'll have like a four of Buddhas, a three of Buddhas, and a two of Buddhas. They'll have a five of samurai, a four of samurai, or whatever. They'll have these exact same set of tiles, but the order in which you draw them is obviously going to be different for everyone. And then on your turn, your whole action is just take a tile from behind your screen and place it somewhere on the board, and then potentially cause a conflict if you've surrounded that piece, which is like, it's dead simple. And then when like the game ends, when the whole board is full or when everyone's spent all their tiles, like it's just such a simple teach that follows on from games like Through the Desert and games like Babylonia, Yellow and Yangtze, and Tigris and Euphrates as well. You can see all of this sort of like design lineage come out in this game. Well, this is the start of that lineage, I suppose. I like this game, but I didn't love it because I think I'm not smart enough for it.
Maybe you're thick. Like, no, I don't. To me, it's like almost like going shopping. Like, it's almost like how I play deck builders. I look at the board and then I look for something that's like a little vulnerable and I go, go in there. I'm looking for bargains when I play Samurai.
Right.
I go, I think I could get that castle for cheap.
Yes.
And then maybe a player swoops in or not. I'm also looking for moves where I can place down a hexagon, which seems, this is maybe where it gets a little more cunning. I look for, because especially in a four-player game, you're going to place a hexagon and then three players have a chance to jump in and ruin your stuff. Like, if you're setting up to win a battle, a player can just jump in and place a higher tile, for example. So I would look for moves where I would place a tile and it seemed so innocuous that players wouldn't notice that then the next statue over is now suddenly one tile away from being filled up, something like that.
Yeah, I do think one of the things that I really like about this game is how all the tiles are unique. But I also like the way that melds with the fact that you have this sort of limited hand that means that the decision-making process is much less like agonizing. Like, because you'll look at the things you have and you'll put something down the board and you'll immediately be like, oh, well, maybe that wasn't like the best possible use for that tile in that moment. But it's what you had at the time and you couldn't have foreseen, what was going to come out next and you couldn't have foreseen what your opponent has. So it is this really like nice sort of like soft mesh of strategy and tactics where you just have to sort of literally play the hand you're dealt and you can only sort of like reach for the plays you have at the time, which means that like rarely in this game did I feel like super full of analysis paralysis. Because it's so abstract, I thought this game would be kind of like unfriendly to like play. But I was kind of pleasantly surprised by the fact that it was quite easygoing and maybe more easygoing than like some of the other sort of abstract tile-y sort of games in this sort of Reiner Knizia vein.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think you're onto something there. I think it hadn't occurred to me before, but every time I've played Samurai, everyone at the table has had a pretty good time. I think you might be the person who's liked it the least.
Yes.
It's actually a really rare thing. It's an abstract game that is crunchy, but isn't going to sear your brain. You know, it's because, I don't know, you're collecting just one statue at a time. Everyone's going to go home with some statues. Like in our game, the person who came first only had like two or three more statues than the person who came last. Yes. It was just all about which statues you collected. So everyone goes home with something. It's got like a kind of, what if an abstract game had the vibe of a friendly little game show? That's maybe. But one thing we didn't play with that I think would make this game mega crunchy is there's one tiny little rule in the manual that says if you're an advanced player or if you're familiar with the game, you can decide what your opening hand is. So out of the 20 tiles that everyone starts with, which includes some cool stuff like swap a tile or swap a statue or boats that go in the sea, splash around Japan and can surround tiles that are on the coast. I think if you were to pick your own starting tiles, you could get into some really fun stuff really quickly because Luke won our game partially by just surrounding Tokyo because he had the tiles for it.
Yes.
And I think if everyone had their opening hands to like either go for Tokyo or swap out tiles that had already gone for Tokyo and bung them somewhere useless. Mm. I don't know. I think you get into some really, really good crunch there.
Yeah, some really good crunch and some absolutely brain melting crunch as well. I think that even the decision of what to put in that first hand would be, it'd be gross. It'd be nasty.
Yeah. But also then the game is so fast. It's over in like 30 minutes, 45 minutes.
Yeah, that's very true.
I think, I don't know, I would describe Samurai ultimately as slick. I think the rules are so small. The design is so cute. It's quite a smooth puzzle. I think you had a harder time with it than anyone I've met. Everybody goes home feeling like they achieved a little something and could do a little bit better next time.
Yeah.
I think this is just a very solid game. The kind of game that shows Nitya's like design backbone and how strong it is.
The thing that here's my point of comparison between these two Reina Knizia games that we played. And I like both of them. I just think I preferred Taj Mahal. I think that Taj Mahal kind of felt like a contemporary art exhibition. There's like lots of angles. It's a little confusing. It's very like colorful. And like you can interpret it in lots of like fun ways. Samurai was like a marble bust, like a head, like a big marble head. And like, it's really, it's cool. I can like really appreciate the craftsmanship on show. I think it's very sleek and very like, oh yeah, looks good. But I'm not going to spend that much time thinking about it afterwards. And I didn't think about Samurai much after I played it. I went, nice. And then kind of just like very quickly evacuated it from my brain because it is this game that has... Because it is a sort of, I don't know, it's kind of just like very smart and clean, and that's all to me.
And I couldn't agree more. It's also a little bit forgettable. Like, there's a reason that I've had Samurai in my collection the entire time I've known you, but I was like, oh, Tom, have you seen Through the Desert? Oh, Tom, have you seen Tigris and Euphrates? Right. Oh, Tom, have you seen Modern Art? Like, My City? Like, all these Reina Knizia games, which are just truly great. Samurai isn't truly great. I'm just glad I have it because I think it's a nice marble bust to have in my collection, and the addition I have is really nice.
I just like, even just the mention of like Tigris and Euphrates just made me think about how much more like zesty and spicy Tigris and Euphrates is. It's so much less intellectual as a game. Like, it's just, it's, there's more.
Wait, you
like,
think Tigris is less intellectual?
Yes. I think Samurai is like, it's like a classical composition, and Tigris and Euphrates is kind of like, it's like free jazz, baby. It's like free jazz. The third game that we played on our big day of games was Mundus Novus. This was the game that we brought to the pub. This was a game where Quinns had to sequester himself away at a separate table to learn the rules. It was a game that we might have made a bit sticky with our fingers full of food.
You did the thing which is inevitable now when one of us goes into a corner to learn rules, which is you take a photo of them reading lonely in a corner, looking stressed. It's like a shut up and sit down tradition.
It's fun. It's very fun. And so's Mundus Novus. How's that for a cool segue?
Nice.
This is designed by Bruno Cathala and Serge Legette, who created games such as Shadows Over Camelot, the first ever social deduction hidden role game, right? Or close to the first ever, or popularized it. Serge Legette sadly passed away early this year in January and will be missed. Contributed lots of great games to this hobby. Mundus Novus is one of those great games, and it's a really great collaboration between these two designers. It's old. You can't get your hands on this game anymore, I don't think. And I know that because I checked straight away after playing it.
Oh, really?
I had a really lovely time with this game. And I think that it's not perfect. It's not like sort of the greatest thing I've ever played. But we hit on this pretty early that it's kind of a game of being relaxed around nice people who you like. There is just enough thinking in this game, and there is just enough doing, as in like passing cards and like exchanging cards and like looking at each other and making not deals, but little mini trades. There's lots of exchanging going on. And I think that makes it this sort of very warm and cozy game that I just sort of felt very at peace playing, even though it's super colonialist.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. It's so funny hearing you describe it as like, you know, there's just enough of everything. It's just fine. It's just fun. All of which is true. And the theme is like properly just rape and pillage the New World. You are playing proper conquistadors, like literally card depictions of conquistadors that you're acquiring. And then you're sailing boats to South America. Then each round you kind of come back with cargo holds of different stuff. The one thing, this game came out before, you know, like very sensible discussions about like, hey, this seems like kind of weird to have, you know, like sort of the destruction of an indigenous people that were considered subhuman at the time as like a fun theme for a board game. But the one thing it does have going for it in the back of the manual, when you draw a card and it's like, you know, oh, this is Francesco, whatever, famous real life colonialist. You can turn to the back of the manual, and where his power is explained, there's also an italicized paragraph telling you the history of this person. Mm. And almost all of them are like, end with like, was killed in a rainforest or was torn apart by hungry dogs. they all came, well, generally, a lot of them came to bad ends.
Wow.
Because it was a dangerous job. But yes, so deeply problematic theme, Very strong game. Tom, would you like to describe what you do in Mundus Novus?
It's a hard one to explain. But basically, the way this game works is you're going to have a hand of different goods range from 1 to 10. And the 10 goods, typically, better than the 1 goods. The higher a good is, the more useful it is for buying things from a market and potentially being the first in turn order. That's the general rule for these cards. So you draw a hand of cards, and then whoever the harbor master or quartermaster is for the
round... Trademaster,
will declare how many cards are going to be exchanged or swapped or traded by all players in this round. Each player will... So they might say 2 cards this round. Each player then takes 2 cards from their hand and places them face up in front of them. And then everyone will do these sort of trades where you will take a card from someone else, and then that person who you just took a card from will then get to take a card from someone else. And the person they took a card from then will take a card from someone else until all the cards are gone and you've sort of rebuilt your hand back up to 5 cards again. Really odd little dance that happens in this game where you draw a hand of 5 and you sort of like bin off a bit of it and then get it back again. It's really strange.
It's one of the moments of design alchemy that, like, you know, you'd think that just sounds like a rule you have to teach, right? That, like, you know, oh, this round the trademaster yells 3, so I put down a vanilla and a tobacco and a Inca idol. And then players pick it up and I pick up cards from them. That sounds like busy work, right? But card games are weird. In play, that feels fantastic.
It's very nice. So smooth.
You do it. It's such a simple process. You can do it while having a conversation about something else. And like, you're collecting things from other players. And every time you do, you give them the opportunity to collect something else. So it just feels really warm. Especially so because then what you do with these hand of cards is you make sets. You can either have a set of all the same cards in order to acquire a permanent upgrade from the market, which is like, you know, which is where you get these conquistadors from that will give you special rules. You can get special merchants. You can get warehouses to store cards between rounds, or boats that give you more cards at the start of a round, which is very exciting. So it's the way I'd pitched it to Tom and his friends is it's like a sort of card game of set building plus Euro game. Like, it's got like permanent upgrades that you get. And then the other thing you do with these hands of trade good cards is if you don't make sets of the same number, you can cash in sets of all different numbers for cash.
Yes.
And cash is how you ultimately win the game.
It's just the person who has the most money. Well, the person who, is it $75 is the first
75 doubloons will win you the game. You can win the game early, however, by cashing in a set of a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, all the way up to a 10. Which I've never seen before, but just the existence of that rule and the fact that it's possible and the fact that players can try and get it makes everybody very excited for the duration of Mundus Novus. Again, a peculiar thing where a rule that just sounds awkward actually gives the game this weird bed of electricity that everyone's like, oh, someone could cash in a set of 10 at any moment. It's not true. I've never seen anyone do it, but like, I'm sure it happens and it's cool that it can happen.
I sort of want to issue a correction on what on an earlier thing you said, which is more accurately, I think, you described this as what if Bonanza was an economic game? Or what if Bonanza was... Sorry, what if Bonanza was a Euro game?
Yeah, yeah, it's a bit of that, isn't it?
Because it's like...
some trading and then there's permanently upgrading your bean farm.
Yeah, and there's that something that's really nice about it is that, like, I really enjoyed the way that... Because a lot of the sort of cards that you can get are sort of unique. A lot of the, like, conquistador characters that you can pull out from this big deck are unique, alongside the sort of more standard upgrades, like warehouses to keep cards, ships to draw more cards, etc., etc. That stuff does give each player a kind of, like, unique character around the table.
It does. It really does.
My character was very boring. I literally just tried to collect all the things that would give me a drip of income every round and then just won the game by passive income, which kind of feels wrong, but also kind of how the world is.
I thought about this, and you know the reason that happened, Tom, is because for, like, 4 rounds in a row, we had that event which was like, nobody can sell their trade goods for money.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you wouldn't. You still might have won if that had been the case, but it was if the rest of us had been better Mundus Novus players, we would have seen that event coming and realized that your passive income would have meant you're the only player making money for multiple rounds in a row.
It felt real good. It did feel real good. But then, like, next to me, like, Kathy was playing, when she was playing the game next to me, her whole strategy was revolved around playing this sort of weird kind of slot machine thing where there are these three cards in the middle of the table that you can always trade with. And if she could line up the same number or sets of numbers in that shop, then she would get a little payout. And that was something that everyone was kind of aware of.
So weird and so awesome that, like, you know, and occasionally we started like trying to nudge the slot machine to make it harder for her to make money. Super funny.
And then I can't remember exactly what Luke's character was, but he had some weird stuff going on that I didn't quite, was slightly inscrutable. He was the events man.
He had this nonsense. Yeah, he could, if there was no event that round, he could call an event. He could, you know, he had the insane ability of being able to ignore the trade master. So if the trade master goes, "We're all trading four goods," he's like, "No, I'm not." Which is just bizarre. And then I had lots of boats, lots and lots and lots of boats. So at the start of each round, where you all got five guards cards, I had eight.
Yes.
Which, again, like, very characterful, very peculiar.
And also, I love the fact that the more boats that you have, the slower you are, because it's like a big fleet. Yes. So it's like, if, like, Luke had like one boat that was very fast, and so he would just be able to nab the first thing from that little shop of options. Whereas you had like, yeah, like five boats or whatever, all just sort of,
which means I got the five, yeah, that could not fit onto the dock at all. So I got whatever five cards were left while after everyone else with boats had hoovered up all the gold and vanilla and just crap from the stocks.
Very
silly. I got, you know, some potatoes and some tobacco. And it's like, cool. It's good. It's just good. And now that Bonanza's, you know, retheming has been announced with, it's Bonanza, but instead of beans, you're trading poppies, which Shut Up and Sit Down has mixed feelings about, because we, anyway. And now that Ethnos is being reprinted as well, right? Another game with a questionable theme that is getting a new good theme.
Maybe it's Mundus Novus's time.
Maybe Mundus Novus, some publisher listening to this should pick up the rights for Mundus Novus and do a version which, I don't know,
is old, even like, more colonialist.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what should happen. That's what I was going to say. And finally, I closed out Tom and my game day by introducing to a Japanese game from 2007 called Parade, which was picked up by Zedman Games. And I think that was a very smart move, because I think this game is good. Board Game Geek does not. Board Game Geek gives it 7.0 out of 7,000 ratings, which I think is absolutely outrageous. This is a design by a titan of the Japanese board game design scene, Naoki Homma. And it has a pretty cursed Alice in Wonderland theme that has not changed since the original 2007 printing. And I kind of like that just for confidence and commitment. If you can find the Zedman Classic Card Games version, which is purple and like really distinctive looking, it's pretty handsome. Although, yeah, but Tom had some I brought out this really nice box, the Parade box, and I brought out these cards, and the card back is gorgeous. This is the same line of games that brought out the original Arboretum. If you remember how beautiful that was. And then I dealt Tom a hand of cards and he looked at those cards. And Tom, how would you describe how you felt when you saw the art on the front of these cards?
Yucky. Or actually, maybe not yucky, just a little disappointed. Because those card backs are gorgeous. They're so sumptuous. The box is lovely. And you look at the cards and you go, a little bit.
Yeah. It's like a really gross Humpty Dumpty, a slightly troubled and gross white rabbit. There's Alice looking not great. The Cheshire Cat looks fine.
Everyone's looking a bit worse for wear.
Yeah, it's like everyone's hungover and they just were like woken out of bed by a fire alarm, which is kind of how the game makes you feel, honestly. in the game of Parade, there's a parade happening in Wonderland. And on your turn, you're going to take a card from your hand, which is always one of the six Alice in Wonderland characters in the game. They run from 0 to 10. So it's 0 to 10 in each of six characters for 60 cards. Everyone has a hand of five cards, and on your turn, you play a card onto the end of a parade, which is a big snaking length of cards in the middle of the table, as if all the characters are like doing a conga line. Mm-hmm. Except it's a conga line you do not want to get involved with, because explaining this game. So let's imagine I played a five of Humpty Dumpty onto the end of the parade.
Ridiculous. Here's what happens next. Ridiculous sentence.
I know. I kind of enjoy teaching this game for how dumb it is, but it's really good. So you play a five of Humpty Dumpty. First off, Humpty Dumpty's on the end of the parade, right? So then you count five cards in from Humpty Dumpty because you played the number five. One, two, three, four, five. Five cards in. There are probably more than five cards in the parade. All the remaining cards enter what is called removal mode. So if you play a 10 and there are 10 cards in the parade, you're safe. You don't have to remove anyone from the parade because everyone you remove from the parade is potentially negative points for you. Well, they are negative points. They just might be better or worse. So let's stick with our example. We play a five Humpty Dumpty. Let's say there are five other cards left in the parade. Any cards left in the parade that are in removal mode that are Humpty Dumpty, I take. And any cards that are equal or lower to five, I also take. So if I play, to give you another example, a zero dodo onto the end of the parade, because the number is zero, every other card in the parade is in removal mode. So I'm going to take all the dodos and I'm going to take all cards that are number zero or lower. So we're then going to do this going around the table until the deck runs out. And we all have a variety of reprobates in front of us who we couldn't avoid picking up. All of those cards are negative points. And worse, the points they are is whatever the number on the card is. So if you pick up a nine Alice, that is nine negative points. And there are only negative points in this game, to clarify. So like, the more points you collect, the worse you're doing. However, at the end of the game, what the players are going to do is they're going to look and see whoever has the most of each person. So if I have the most Alices for a total of, like, I don't know, negative 41 points, because I have the most Alices, I'm going to turn them all face down, and each card only counts as one negative point. So there are two ways to get a good score in Parade, one of which is to, by and large, just avoid picking up things for the duration of the game. That, however, is very risky, because if at the end of the game you have to pick up cards, you're probably not going to have the most of them. You're screwed.
It's exactly what happened to me.
It's exactly what happened to Tom. The other way to play is to go, I don't care, I don't care, give them all to me, and then just really bank on having the most of particular people. However, the unfortunate thing about this strategy is it's very risky, because if you, you know, aim to collect the most Alice and have tons of them, and then another player just pips you out at the end of the game, you're screwed, because you don't flip all your Alices and you've got, you know, negative 400 points or whatever. So that's Parade. It's a long, rambly discussion of what is ultimately a pretty simple game. I basically taught you the entire game, though,
yeah,
to be fair. There's no real additional rules to that, aside from at the end of the game, you can, of the four cards you've got left in hand at the end of the game, you can pick two that you must add to your scoring area. So there's a bit of hand management there as well, because you want to surprise a player who thinks they have, like, the most dodos by suddenly, da-da, you drop two dodos into your scoring area and that player just punches you in the mouth, because
mm-hmm.
you've made a farce of their game.
As is their right.
As is their right, yeah. That's Parade. Tom, what did you think of Parade?
I liked it. I thought
it's
was good.
It's good. It's better than a seven, Board Game Geek.
I will say, I think this is the, one of the only things I've got written in my little notes that I've written for Parade is, bring it back to the start of the podcast, of all of the games we played, this is the only one where I really did feel like you had an advantage of having played it already, because you immediately pursued that strategy of gathering loads and loads of different animals or Alice in Wonderland characters so that you had the most of them. Because I don't think any of us had clocked that you could possibly, like, it's going to be pretty much impossible to play the game without picking up anything. And so it's about what you try and strategically pick up over other players. And I think that strategy served you really well, where, like, the rest of us were kind of being like, oh, I'm going to try not to pick up anything at all. When really the best option is to, like, choose two characters that you're just going to gun for maybe, like, the whole game. I had a really pleasant time.
I would argue that if I was playing with people who were, I might use the word intelligent, mm-hmm. canny,
yes.
they might have looked at the size of the deck, done a couple of sums in their head and realized, and or dude, just watched the experienced player start playing a certain way and gone, I can use common sense to determine that this is the way to play. However, you guys, a bunch of, dare I say it, drunken cowards did not fling yourselves into the teeth of negative scoring. So actually, I don't think you saw Parade at its very best, because Parade, at its, if two players know kind of that this is the strategy and this is what you do, the moment one of you takes a bunch of a particular color, then it's kind of like the starting gun firing, because the other player can then be like, well, I'm going to hoover up all that character as well. And then you're playing Russian roulette where one of you has to lose.
Yes.
And if you've got a table of five players doing that, then it's just, then, well, also, then it becomes, if you lot had actually decided that collecting the most of particular colors was good, Parade is a flexible enough game that then a player who decides not to collect anything might have been able to do that. Because if all the players are racing to collect certain colors, suddenly maybe it is possible to go the game without collecting any colors.
I really want to play this game again. Is my sort of main takeaway from it. Because I think that, like, I had a very, very, very pleasant and fun time playing it. I think that there's a really, like, it's a really odd strategy to kind of, like, tack onto, I think. I always find it really interesting when a game is only negative points and it's about trying to avoid them.
It's such a stupid psychological wrinkle, yeah.
I know, absolutely. And I think that, like, I think that it's, in sort of, in terms of its simplicity, I think lining it up with those other sort of, like, the Zedman games in the sort of same box size, I don't know if both of these games are in the same line, but comparing it to Arboretum, because it's in the same line, because it's the same sort of size, Arboretum's a little bit too complicated. It takes up too much table space. It's a little bit fiddly to teach. And then
Arboretum is like the I don't know, it's the game equivalent of a meal that has like 14 steps that when you have it, you're like, this is delicious, but can you be bothered to cook it? Can you? I don't think you're going to make this more than once every 2 years.
I love Arboretum, like every single time I play it, but teaching it to people is kind of agonizing. And the other game
playing it is agonizing. What are you talking about? Playing it, like every turn in Arboretum is like an aneurysm.
That's very true. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I was thinking about Archaeology as well.
See, one of my like Darkest Horse favorite games. No one likes Archaeology except me, including you. And I know you played it wrong, but like you're like, oh, we played it this way and there wasn't much to it. It's like, Tom, there's not much to it whichever way you play it. even if you don't have the ability to visit the landmarks, as it happened when you play. I love Archaeology. I think it's really cool.
I sort of want to play Archaeology again, but right, and also after like a few pints, I think.
Archaeology is a great game to play with everyone putting like a pound coin into the pot and then the winner takes all. Because it's really just gambling.
And I think the thing that I was thinking though is like Archaeology a little bit too simple, Arboretum a little bit too complex, Parade sort of sitting perfectly in the middle as this game that has like the luck and it has silliness and it has groaning that is present in all three of these games, to be quite frank. But it's also like the simplest to teach and the sort of the most like thought-provoking without being like, you know, thought-destroying in the same way that Arboretum is, where it sounds that your brain is being pushed through a blender.
Describing Arboretum as thought-destroying is really good. But I'm just actually going to ask you to stick a pin in that particular decision, because while Parade is a really happy medium between the idiocy of Archaeology and the phenomenal strategy of Arboretum, next time we do one of these game days in which you have one more opportunity to win my treasure, I'm going to introduce you to Lords of Scotland, which sits between Arboretum and Parade, which is in the same Zedman Classic Card Games line.
Lovely.
It sits between Arboretum and Parade in terms of complexity. And you play Scots having a fight.
That was really convincing, that accent there.
I know. It was, wasn't it? I'm always surprised by my hidden depths.
Do you want to outro us?
I do want to outro us, but first I want to apologize for that Scottish accent, because I know we have lots of Scottish listeners, and I'm sorry.
You did
them
wrong.
To Scotland soon. I did. My wife is America and she's never been to Scotland. So Scottish people, you should know that I'm going to Scotland to leave some money smeared around your tourist industries. That's good. And if you don't agree that it's good, then maybe you can find me and we can have a fight.
That accent is staying in Brighton. While you go to Scotland.
Oh, no, Tom, I'll be going to Glasgow, I'll be going to Aberdeen. You know, they won't understand me unless I do that accent. So actually, that accent very much has to come with me. And they'll be like, are you from around here? And I'll say, I'm actually not. That has been the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, everybody. What do we have coming up on the YouTube channel?
The YouTube channel, we should very soon have a big video review of Frosthaven coming soon.
Wow.
The massive box that Matt has taken a big chunk of the review for. I've done some little segments for it, and I think they're very silly. So I'm quite looking forward to that. Or one of them is very silly. One of them is just like a buyer's guide, but the other one is very silly.
Did you do that thing where you reviewed the inlay?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Nice. Nice.
Who
nice,
knows
nice.
If Matt will include it, because it's pure nonsense.
Well, now you've said that, if it's not in the video, Matt's going to be the villain of this week on Shut Up and Sit Down.
Yeah. We've got another big box review coming a little bit after that, but I'll keep a lid on what that is. I'll be secretive about that, what it is. I mean, actually, I haven't been secretive about what it is. You can find out if you watch the Twitch. On every Tuesday, we do Twitch streams.
So you just talk about all the secret stuff.
I just spill the beans, yeah, live on air. So yeah, that's what's coming up on the YouTube. And then I think podcast-wise, we've got some pretty fun ones in the pipe as well. You're going to tell us about Goering's Game Gulag.
The next episode of the podcast will be, hopefully, Tom and Matt grilling me about my time in Ohio in Alan Gerding's Game Gulag, aka Cabin Con, aka Board Gamers of Greater Akron's meetup, in which, I'll tell you right now, Tom, one of the players got a concussion because of the game. if you want to hear
the
about
game
that
was
story,
boxing.
Sure. The game was just leathering one another. No, the game was a spin-off of Werewolf, and a player almost got hospitalized. So to find out about that, do tune into the next episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. Take care, everybody.
Bye.